Welcome to Holden Village. In the fireside room, Glenn Gershmel will be speaking on Forgiveness in Politics, Hiroshima, 1995. So let's listen in on Glenn.
I have very ambitious goals for this session. To take an event like Hiroshima and center a goal or a reflection on hope. To secondly look at a variety of levels of the event, political, theological, historical, psychological, to introduce several marvelous resources, which I think I'll name right at the outset, of all of the books that I've read, and it's several dozen on World War II. War Without Mercy, Race and Power in the Pacific War by John Dower is one of the most amazing and useful. And a book that just came out a couple months ago by Union Theological Seminary ethicist Donald Shriver, with my favorite book title of the year, An Ethic for Enemies, Forgiveness in Politics, Oxford University Press. We've liked it so much in LPF that we've ordered a bunch of copies and we're selling them to people who are, you know, as they join or order note cards or other books or whatever, you can just add a little more. In fact, we as we do with all books, we reduce the price a little bit to just make it a little easier. And I guess the focal point I'd like or a good starting point maybe is a better way of putting it, is the opportunity that's presented both with the 50th anniversary being this year, but the fact that August 6th falls on a Sunday this year, and it's moved LPF to call on synods and congregations to observe August 6th as a day of prayer for peace. And what I'd like to start with is what are your thoughts about how your congregation or your group or your seminary or college or community could take advantage of the opportunity that is presented by the fact that August 6th falls on a Sunday to engage people in the political issues, in the questions of repentance and forgiveness, in the peacemaking activities of bridging gulfs between races, Japanese and Asian Americans in your community, for example, Japanese citizens who then will also be observing activities, in taking advantage of the worship possibilities, the educational possibilities, the action, political action, ethical action possibilities. Let me start by throwing the ball out onto the table and asking your thoughts, brainstorm fashion. No censorship, no unnecessary barriers to free thinking.
Do you have my chance to check out the lessons for that Sunday?
Yeah. I think I think it's Mary and Martha. Apologize, I don't have them at my fingertips.
No, that's okay.
That's a good one. Sure, of course.
Start there, right. And look for bridges and so forth for the actual Sunday.
Exactly, right.
You can usually always find some way. I can't anyway.
Yeah.
Well,
I will be proposing some options that really make some sense. But other thoughts?
Well, I could encourage the person who is responsible for prayers to make sure that there's one of some sort. I mean, if they're not doing anything else, at least you could do that. And maybe help spread the prayer if necessary.
All right. So, this is kind of an condition for this. Other thoughts? Not necessarily on that, in that category of activity. Texts, prayers.
think the priest at our church plans to do a Sunday school class discussing this issue. And I think it's going to be a series of classes. I don't believe that it's just one Sunday.
I've heard numerous Lutherans say, we don't have adult forums in summer. And I can't think of a better occasion or a better reason, even if three people come, you know, to break that tradition or whatever.
Yeah, and he uses that engaging the powers. Which is very much his thing.
We have a lot of Japanese students in our community. We have one of the Teikyo universities. And for the last 2 years, I've been teaching English to these kids. And they, I know they all have had homestays. And one thing that could happen is a homestay, parents could make it a point of inviting those kids to come and visit them on that Sunday in order to attend the service, or something would be mentioned about it. The problem I have with even doing that, like the kids I know, the kids I could invite them to. What concerns me about it, though, is I guess what our relationship to the event will be in contrast to what their view of the event is. Because everybody in Japan, all school kids in Japan, take annual field trips to Hiroshima. They make it a big deal. It is a big event to go and visit the site, which they think, which they almost revere as the supreme sacrifice, or, well, not supreme sacrifice, but the most devastating thing that could have ever happened to a group of people. And they don't see it as it stopped the war, it saved millions of other people from dying, the way we look at it more. They see it as, we just wiped out all these innocent people, you know, it's over. And that's the way they view it. And I'd almost be a little bit afraid of inviting some of my students to come, almost for fear of what would be said in a Sunday school class and how we would approach it versus how they approach it.
Well, they're right. They're right, we did kill a lot of innocent people.
We did.
Yeah, that happened all over the world. There were a lot of innocent people killed in Dresden and London.
They consider the kamikaze pilots as making supreme sacrifice. And you say, hey, they wiped out a ship. The kamikaze pilot went down, they wiped out a whole ship. So, you know, we're coming at the issue from two very different points of view, and I don't know if the two could meet on that day and somehow celebrate the idea of peace together.
Which means you'd have to not look at the past, because we're never going to get out of that dilemma. And you have, and maybe the thrust of something like this would have to be, look, how do we build bridges? I mean, it seems to me that we have to have something like that wherever you have longstanding problems in the world or in the neighborhood that you have to look ahead.
But that's my point. They're renewing the memory. They are constantly going back, and they've got the site. And they constantly take the kids there so that they can remember what happened there. And we're looking at it, yeah, let's go on from here.
I think we all need to keep the memories, because then we can see what we need to change.
And we avoid another.
But you need to keep the whole memory, not just part of it. And the Japanese are looking at part of it.
Which
change the whole picture.
Which I think we do too. We look at part of it. We look at our part, they look at their part, and we have to be able to see each other's part.
I think a lot of this is, for me at least, in my context, is going to be determined by how this is played out in the media and what my people have been responding to in the weeks leading up to it, and it's almost going to have to be adapted towards the end. I have not done much read, but I've read just here and there that at least some factions, parties within Japan are more ready to acknowledge the complicity of the Japanese people in all of this, as in Germany, of course, too. You get those who are old nationalists, hardliners, you get the new. So a lot will depend upon what the people are seeing on the screen, reading in the magazines and the papers. And if it makes it a lot easier for a pastor if that coverage is already balanced, and the ambiguity of all our good intentions and all our efforts is shown on both sides, and then that gives you more of an access. I don't see it as a celebration at all, but I see it certainly more as moving, as a confession and moving on and acknowledging the ambiguities of all our efforts and so forth. But I know for myself that I'm going to have to see as
do some fine tuning
what's going on. Yeah.
I guess
I have veterans in my congregation and that kind of thing, and so I might want to be talking to them too.
Right.
And say, what are you feeling at this point?
So, right. And be able to quote them, you know, in sermons. Well, let me throw a challenge at your feet. I think you're right, and I'm certainly going to be doing that as well. I would propose that all of you consider yourselves actors in that media discussion. With the lead time that you have, a month and a half before it happens, more, I would propose that it would be possible for you to do some thinking, just even in the odd moments of here at Holden or at home, to craft some of the pieces or draw, you know, underline some of the materials that I can share with you, but some of the elements of one or more really wonderful, very useful letters to the editor or articles that would help make that media coverage balanced. One of the nice things about U.S. media, and I have to say there, a lot of times I wonder how many good things there are, is that the letters of the editor columns are among the most read parts of the newspaper and most broadly read. There really is a forum there that you can participate in, the talk shows. I'm amazed at how many times I've gone from being angry at some talk show that I've happened on in the media to dialing it up and actually gotten on. And, you know, with just a little bit of thought, you can really make a contribution to tens of thousands of people. But I'm really delighted at how the discussion is moving here, because I think the question of memory is really central to this kind of an issue. And certainly, you've all noted the polarization and the diversity of view and the movement that's occurring among different groups. And I'm going to take a moment to share just a couple thoughts about it. One of the great things about Shriver is how balanced and how thoughtful and how careful he is to try to give justice to the various points of view. And he begins the chapter 5, on Japan and the United States with some really interesting quotes, and with this comment: pain can sear the human memory in two crippling ways, with forgetfulness of the past or imprisonment in it. The mind that fixes on pain risks getting trapped in it, too horrible to remember, too horrible to forget. Down either path lies little health for the human sufferers of great evil. Or the response of young people in Germany or Japan or the United States: we have our own problems, our own challenges. We have to get on with our own future, however instructive you may think your past is. To this complaint, the survivors of old evil have one very pragmatic reply. The evils you face have some of their roots in the past. Our past in your present threatens your future. And I think it's commonsensical to say there's sometimes when I avoid the past. I mean, I think it's there because of time or whatever. It's easier to just to look into the future. But Hiroshima Sunday, I think, in some unalterable ways, it encourages us to look at the past. And Shriver, I think, gives us some real help in saying, in demarcating four principles for looking at the past, four principles for reconciliation that I think are very helpful for me. In fact, a subject that I've thought as much about this, I'm stunned at how much I felt like I learned. The four principles that he has are: one, moral truth; two, forbearance; three, empathy; and four, commitment to repair fractured human relations. And each one of these can be seen to help us overcome a very common problem with human relations or with dealing with the past. Forgive and forget is the kind of cliche or the saying. And he contrasts that with a notion much, much more useful would be remember and forget. That, in fact, forgiveness begins, he says, with memory suffused with moral judgment.
I found that to be particularly true. You have to remember, or we'll just go at it again. I mean, as soon as the Gulf War started, I thought, oh, not again. Somehow we have not been able to get it across that war is bad. I guess I was one of the few people who thought that.
Right.
Everybody else was cheering on, let's do this to them. Not again.
I came across an interesting story in working on this over the last few months that a filmmaker, well-known filmmaker in the 50s and 60s and 70s, was a part of a team of people that went into Hiroshima and filmed the evidence, the remains. And it was classified immediately and not released. And he tells a two-page odyssey of his attempts to try to get it released, have it made into something, get the footage himself and be allowed to do it. He had all kinds of friends in the military and as well as in film, so that it wouldn't have been that difficult. He's a very decent human being. I mean, he wasn't going after it with the kind of, you know, fire in his eyes that sometimes makes people want to like clamp down and pretend like the film footage disappeared or something. And it was really testimony to the propensity of political institutions as well as the human mind to want to ignore.
Would you just read those, forgive and forget, and then what did he say after the forgive and forget?
Forgiveness begins with memory suffused with moral judgment. And in fact, that quality that I ascribe to this filmmaker, I think, is important for us. You know, the point where we will lose the ability to be heard will be the point where we appear to be rigidly wanting to get people to, like, face the truth. We didn't like it as kids. I think it's a universal memory of disliking parental or authority's attempts to get us to face up to something, you know. The act almost requires the opposite. The creating of a safe place for people to be able to look at something that they've ignored and it's been difficult. To put out the qualities of flexibility and openness and reason, judgment, and willingness to hear any point of view. Willingness to allow people to say things that they might later think were pretty stupid is I think the quality we want to foster, the atmosphere that we want to create. And forbearance is an interesting word. I wouldn't have predicted that, but Shriver proposes that forgiveness in politics requires the abandonment of vengeance. That that punishment or just retribution inevitably has a place. I mean, the Nuremberg trials, I think most people would regard as a valuable thing for history, as well as an appropriate response to the Holocaust and to World War II on the German side. But vengeance is mine. I spent a lot of time in Washington, D.C. in the 70s and 80s, and I remember one really important experience for me of having spent about a week and a half trying to lobby on something and being just fed up to hear with the cynicism and lack of respect for democracy and a lot of other horrible qualities that I found among the people that I was lobbying in Congress. And I remember it was a Sunday afternoon. I walked around the really beautiful grounds in D.C. in the mall and so forth. And I walked over to the Lincoln Memorial and read, and I encourage you to read, and I will look up before the service that we're doing next week, the words of Lincoln, and I believe it was the Gettysburg Address, where he quoted the Bible, you know, saying, "Vengeance is mine," and said, in effect, I cannot judge the South or Southerners for what they did. That is God's task. What I can do is rebuild. And I remember just how powerful an effect that had on me. You know, I mean, if Lincoln could say that, you know, in the midst of that war, what right do I have to bear grudges or to withhold the possibility of forgiveness, to go over the line from justice to vengeance, is not something that is given to us. And Lincoln was quoting, you know, both the Bible but also kind of common assumptions that I think, frankly, to our detriment, have vanished from our discourse. Yeah.
I think there's more to it than that, though, because Hiroshima, Tokyo have all been rebuilt with American dollars. The cities have been rebuilt. And yet they maintain in Hiroshima a shrine or a monument to the devastation. I don't know if it's a wiped out place that they did not rebuild on or just what it looks like. I haven't seen it. But the fact that the cities, I mean, Tokyo is a beautiful city today because of the fact that it was bombed. Well, it didn't have the atom bomb, but it was bombed enough that they...
It was destroyed.
It was destroyed. Yeah. And so...
Totally.
And just like some of the German cities, too, are beautiful new cities. And you look at some of our crumbling inner cities and what's happening in this country, right, and some of the other places where American dollars didn't go in afterwards to rebuild. It's more than just a matter of rebuilding. Because I think back in 1945, we thought, okay, we will help you rebuild. And so I think there's a psychological meeting that has to be met. I'm not sure it's what it is.
Well, I'm not sure I understand what you're saying. I mean, it leads naturally to the notion of empathy, the critical importance of empathizing, not sympathizing necessarily, that may not be possible, but empathizing with the other side. And I guess I would encourage you, if I understand you correctly, to empathize with somebody who lived in that city, someone who maybe was out of the city at the time but came back to Nagasaki or to Hiroshima or to Tokyo, where 10 square miles of the city were leveled in one night. A firestorm was created. It was just a physics problem that was solved by 1,000 bombers, and with the first wave dropping in fragmentation bombs that would sort of mix up the rubble a little bit, and then incendiary bombs, phosphorus and a primitive kind of napalm that just lit fires all over, and just by the convection currents gradually just created firestorms that made canals boil, melted metal, just flattened even like substantial structures under the heat. When we think about it from that standpoint, I mean, it's not enough that it was rebuilt. I mean, there's something horrible that happened here that can't be... Or am I misunderstanding you?
Well, I know what you mean by rebuilding. I mean, you're saying rebuild the relationship, but I'm saying in 1945, we did think in terms of what needed to be rebuilt right then was the city itself, and we did help them do that.
OK. compared with what happened after World War I, I think the United States
learned from history.
Incredibly admirable. What's
it seems that we sometimes learn something from history.
Right, there's some hope there.
World War I ended with the Versailles Treaty, which was very punitive on Germany.
Terrible. And
had the seeds of World War II built into it.
Right.
And the Marshall Plan after World War II was certainly that we did learn something from World War I.
Acknowledging the enemy's humanity is what how Shriver describes the third point. And the war, I think, typically has brought out the worst in propaganda and the worst in human behavior. But the Pacific War was notable for the egregiousness of the torture and inhumanity. On the Japanese side, the rape of Nanking, it's not just a euphemism to use the word rape. The treatment of POWs by the Japanese was among the worst of any warring culture. The treatment of civilians in areas the Japanese troops move into. And in fact, it became the justification for U.S. Troop behavior that is really painful to read. Charles Lindbergh, the aviator, traveled around the areas that during the war, and told how an unsuspecting Japanese prisoner was given a cigarette, then seized from behind and had his throat slit from ear to ear as a demonstration on how to kill Japanese. He talked about several thousand prisoners taken at a certain place. Quote, only 100 or 2 were turned in. They had an accident with the rest. Journal entry in his diary of July 28 spoke of kicking in the teeth of Japanese. Our boys don't take prisoners, an infantry colonel told him. We're not talking about a private or a corporal. Battle site where Japanese corpses had been ransacked for gold teeth. A cave was filled with dead Japanese who had tried to surrender but had been told, get the hell back in and fight it out. A pilot's alert tent with a naked girl chalked at the bottom and a Japanese skull hung at the top. Report of the slaughter of the inmates of a Japanese hospital. Australians often threw Japanese out of airplanes on their way to prison compounds, then reported that they'd committed hari kari. A patrol unit had taken up the hobby of making pen holders, paper knives, and the like out of the thigh bones of dead Japanese. Of keeping those who captured Japanese who could speak English for questioning and killing the rest. When he finally left the Pacific Islands and cleared customs in Hawaii, he was asked if he had any bones in his baggage. It was, he was told, a routine question. The talk in newspaper accounts all through the war for the beginning of the war of basically observing of the laws of war, noting attempts to prevent civilian deaths, up to the point of the saturation bombing of cities, as I described. 66 Japanese cities were subjected to the kind of firestorm bombing that I described. In many of them, or at least some of them, you know, very little in the way of military productive capability. And Dresden on the Eastern Front standing out in, or the European war standing out in our memory. And each side promoting propaganda that implied that only the other side was doing bad things, we were continuing to do good things. We were, you know, behaving like civilized people. They were, as the New Yorker quoted after the dropping of the atomic bomb, yellow bastards. New Yorker, I mean, the sort of model of civil journalism.
It seems it's almost like a psychological contradiction built into the very concept of war. A healthy whole person cannot kill another person without seeing them somehow inhuman. Otherwise, it creates such a conflict within our own psyche. So you have to dehumanize the enemy in order to fight a war to kill them. And then after dehumanize them in some way to get beyond it. And it's a terribly tension-filled, you know, psyche-busting kind of experience, it seems.
Right.
It almost takes a whole generation to heal.
And in fact, may not. I mean, it may be that people just move on. My feeling increasingly is, you know, as I've wrestled with this, is that we have to be, I think we have to be very critical or very cautious about using that approach of dealing with political events, precisely because of the likelihood of them being repeated. But I think the majority of cases, I mean, the Shriver book just has some stunning examples of both in the German War, there's a full chapter on that, and the Japanese War, the Pacific War, of people behaving like we need to move on. I mean, Bush is, you know, basically dismissing the possibility of apologizing for Hiroshima, for example. And, you know, the gap between the two that several of you have alluded to, between, you know, U.S. and Japanese citizen attitudes about the subject is kind of captured in some polls that that Shriver quotes. A New York Times poll in early December in the two countries found that 40% of Americans thought Japan should apologize for Pearl Harbor, 55% of Japanese Americans did. So, 40% Pearl Harbor, 55%. Now when you come to Hiroshima, it was 16% of the US citizens believed that we should apologize for Hiroshima. 73% of Japanese. We are a long ways from having the place where there's any kind of common ground. And even Pearl Harbor, I mean, that was one that I've always felt was pretty undeniable. But I have to say that Dower and Shriver both make me think twice about it. There's a third book that I would recommend entitled "The Coming War with Japan." Question the value or the point of remembering the surprise of the attack while making light of the clash of national interests which was building up in the Pacific between the U.S. and Japan. Japan needed oil. The United States embargoed that oil. Each had economic and political aspirations in the Pacific. Both nations had reason to fear the intention of the other, but why should American fears of Japan take moral precedence over Japanese fears of America? This is an apt question, of the kind rightly asked by Reinhold Niebuhr and other critics of the moral pretensions of great national powers. That's, I mean, yeah, it was a sneak attack. We've engaged in a variety of sneak attacks in our era. I would say the majority of Americans thought that the surprise attack of the Israelis, in 30 years ago, was a brilliant military maneuver, not a yellow bastard sneaky attack on another country. And even the most defensible piece of the whole puzzle to me, before I began wrestling with these again, yet again maybe, turns out to have some subtleties that you have to say, well, maybe maybe there's another point of view here.
You know, and that's the dilemma we're always in, because it is hard for us to always get the whole picture. And I remember as a child being told by my parents that Roosevelt knew good and well the Sedan was coming.
That what?
That Roosevelt knew good and well that the attack was coming, but did nothing to stop it, or there would have not been an excuse to get into the war. Well, you know, how do we ever know
right.
the whole truth? How do we ever know?
Right. One point that Shriver makes is the importance of Japanese and U.S. historians to collaborate on some of these questions. And there's been several precedents, I mean, several really interesting and important meetings of historians and as well as others to try to wrestle this stuff out. And as so often happens, meetings of troops, I mean, surviving soldiers, Japanese and American soldiers, have often gone further than any other kind of meeting of folks. I mean, there have been some religious meetings that I think have great promise, but I'll hold that out as another possible. Yeah.
And yet one of the problems I see, as in the Vietnam War, for instance, is that we didn't learn enough from World War II is because the people, as a kid growing up through World War II and, you know, after the aftermath of it, nobody talked about it. The
right.
soldiers that went over
right.
there never came, they came back and they never said a word about it. And I remember asking right. my parents or somebody once, how come my uncle, you know, or their friend, how come they never say anything about the war? And they didn't really have an answer for me. My dad wasn't in it, he made torpedoes, but he wasn't too concerned.
Right, right. I mean, and it's such a ubiquitous reality of people coming back. And I've done a lot of work on the 25th and 20th anniversaries of the end of the Vietnam War that's happening right now, too, this year. And one of my favorite books is entitled In Country. It was made into a really splendid movie. If you ever want a discussion starter or a context for young people, and it's this unassailable right of a young girl, a woman, 19 or so years old, to find out more about Vietnam. Her father had died in the war before she was born. I mean, what more convincing reason for someone wanting to figure out what's going on? And it drives the whole book. That is her father figure is also a vet, and they each find some new life. And wonderful, relatively brief novel by Bobby Ann Mason, In Country.
I happened to tune in to a public television documentary this couple months ago about an American soldier from the Vietnam War going back to Vietnam and meeting a North Vietnamese soldier. And the whole thing was each one describing the battle. It was exactly the same battle that they had been in. And they described the battle from each of their own perspectives. I didn't see the whole thing, but what I know is he was taken into the house of this Vietnamese soldier, and they ate around the same table for the Eucharistic theme and,
yes.
and all. And I was in tears watching it. And when those two left, there was definitely all of this having happened. I thought, I don't know the title of it. I don't know.
Uh-huh.
I just know it just was on there.
Yeah, there's several that I could recommend along those lines. Yes.
Another issue that I think needs to be considered is just why the war was fought in the first place. I mean, Japan was going at imperialism. Mm-hmm. They were expanding. They were overcrowded. Mm-hmm. They're living on these little tiny islands, and part of the little islands as it is, and they simply were looking for a way to expand their country. And if you look at the situation today, they are still trying to expand their country through exporting, through sending students over here, you know, and there is still an enormous amount of prejudice against them because of Japanese cars, for instance, taking jobs away from America, and it still is a matter of Japanese expansionism.
Uh-huh.
It's still going on.
Right.
There's still prejudice against it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason for the war in the first place needs to be looked at.
Well, I would agree, and both the European and the Pacific War, that was a fundamental feature, and it's allowed people to call it, as Studs Terkel, unfortunately, calls one of his books The Good War, right? His oral history of World War II. I guess I would want to encourage us to balance that a little bit, though. a college that I taught at, university I taught at, had a large geography department, and one of their many, many, many maps, and 70,000 maps in their collection, was a map about the turn of the century that showed in different colors the possessions of all of the European states. The title of one of the better books about Africa, the history of the last 100 years, captures it, The Scramble for Africa. The sun never sets on the British Empire. I mean, imperialism really got its name from European behavior in the latter part of the last century. And, you know, the United States, if anything, I would propose, and I think historians have made a good case for, figured out that imperialism, where you actually move in and take over a country, doesn't work as well as a slightly subtler but equally effective kind of imperialism, where, you know, Perry, in all the history books, it still uses the word opened Japan, right, with warships. I think I've made my point, but you're right, and yet it wasn't like the only one, and it wasn't so unique, both in the conquering of the Western Hemisphere and in the behavior of the European powers, you know, leading up to the war. I mean, in fact, one of the great things that the United States did at the end of the war was insist that European powers give up their possessions on other continents. And the one tragic exception we made, we desperately wanted France and NATO, and we let them go back into China and ignored our own people's desires about what ought to happen in allowing Ho Chi Minh, who was like the darling of the OSS, the forerunner of the CIA, he was one of their best, like, support people. I mean, they, in terms of rescuing down flyers and providing intelligence on Japanese movements, Ho Chi Minh was great. He was a hero to the American folks that were working over there. One of the leaders tragically died right at the end of the war, and others were snubbed and ignored. Truman never even answered the letters that Ho Chi Minh wrote to the White House. 2 million Vietnamese died at the hands of the Japanese. I mean, which is, just to put it in perspective, about 7 times as many Americans died in the entire World War II. Just to understand the trauma the Vietnamese went through, and yet we were incapable of learning, of understanding the situation on the ground and doing the right thing in that one place in the world, and we paid for it, you know, and in turn visited tenfold and hundredfold on the people that lived there, you know, the fruits of that tragic exception to what was otherwise a really remarkably positive thing that the United States did in world history at the end of World War II. Well, let's come back to the question we started with. What could we do on August 6th to take advantage of this opportunity for reconciliation, both with Japanese Americans, with Asian Americans generally, with Japan, with our own past? What could happen in our congregations, among our friends, in our letter to the editor? I hope you all take me up on that possibility. What could we do?
Well, in a metropolitan area like Oklahoma City, my guess is that there will be events taking place, both educational, reconciliatory, and so forth. And I think one thing that I imagine we could do in parishes is alert people to these things, encourage people to go to them.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Now, usually when I tell my people about a rally or this or that that's going on, and I go and I see maybe one there, I don't just say, oh, the pastor said we should do it, we're going to do it, but if you just get one to do it.
That's
sure.
And just that by your announcing it, you're saying, this is okay, you have permission. This will not be a radical thing to do. Okay.
There's a wonderful candle lantern floating a climax to, or a sort of focal point to a half-day-long event that occurs at Green Lake in Seattle that hundreds and hundreds of people come to now. It's grown each year, and I think can be a model for those kinds of public activities. And lots of cities have been working on it for months, you know, what they're going to do. Give them a call and find out what's happening and see if you can help, or at least be able to encourage other people to help and participate. Other kinds of things that can happen. What else can you do? If we don't think it, we won't do it.
Well, I think every Sunday, our priest prays for nonviolence and the recognition of the violence that we each carry with us. Mm-hmm. And he is so relentless in his constant reminder to us that he has really opened people within the congregation. He's opened them up to be willing to look at other ways at other discussions to get beyond the blame of situations and to look at ourselves. And I think it does take relentlessness in pointing up our own inner violence.
I mean, look at Christ. I mean, it's one of the really great literary devices of the Bible and the New Testament, and I think of any great literature, is the number of times where Peter's stubbornness or the disciples' like bafflement at something that Christ does is just laid out in raw terms, and it helps create some of the drama of the New Testament and the parables and the stories where people say, well, yeah, but all we've got is these two fishes and this bread. You know, like, are you nuts or what? You know, and then Christ will go ahead and act. So, reality, frankly, requires us. You know, we're going against sin. We're going against habit and paralysis of everybody else in the world. You know. This is an insert that went out with the LPF newsletter, and I have extra copies if people want to share it with others, that does several things. One, it gives a variety of suggestions that people can do, both in worship and in education and peace kind of activities. Secondly, we did what we, any newsletter editor just hates to do. We had solicited, edited and typed up and laid out an entire liturgy, and then decided to put that over into as a secondary one into our resource packet, and started from scratch and rewrote and came up with what you see here, because someone made the brilliant suggestion: a liturgy would have an added dimension of relevance and power if we would base it on, and in fact largely use, words given out by the Japanese Evangelical Lutheran Church. What a great idea. And to recommend the use of their readings in the Bible. And I've read them through again this morning, and they're just really wonderful. They're listed there in the middle of the second column, Micah, Ephesians, and John. And perhaps add as an extra reading a testimony of a Hibakusha. Not outrageously blaming of the Americans or anything, but just simply telling the story, giving the testimony of the experience. So we did it. We scrapped one or moved it into the resource packet as some additional material and reworked and rewrote and so forth. And then added the material that you see there just in the top part, and also in the bulletin insert that's the second side of the page. And that was the second thing. Make it as practical as possible. We laid it out even so that all someone has to do is cut off a little line of type along the side of the page.
Where did you send these?
It went out to all LPF people and to all synods. And A press release went out to all synod and other publications encouraging the use of it.
So the congregations don't have it,
I'm sorry?
Congregations don't have it.
It's not being sent to every congregation, but we're trying to make that happen. I mean, we're a one-person staff, you know, the sort of problem and we face. But so here's something that can actually just be reproduced as a bulletin insert. And with both the integrity and I think the moral kind of added dimension of it coming from Japanese themselves. And the one we send out has a little drawing right here. The copy place both didn't print it on the buff paper that looks a little nicer, but also left off the drawing. So I have some extras of these that I brought along to Holden. So the thing that I just passed out here, it has a second kind of a really marvelous interview with a Japanese theologian or church historian, I guess, actually, at the Japan Evangelical Lutheran Seminary, and a little more detailed suggestions of what people can do, including for those that have worked it through far enough, you know, the possibility of joining an apology that's being organized and circulated by the Fellowship for Reconciliation, which has worked for really since 1945 to build, you know, remembrance and moral truth of what happened at Hiroshima.
I've seen this someplace else. Has it been in the Lutheran, or has it been?
Yeah. They've distributed it pretty widely.
The call for repentance and reconciliation.
Are there any?
Yeah, there's some. Right.
What I'm giving you here, the interview, the list of materials, and the call for repentance are all from the LPF newsletter. Those three pages. And the first thing that I handed out is an insert. So at least 1,500 people around the country have it already, and or will get it in the next week or two. This is the third and final page from the newsletter. We devoted three pages to Hiroshima, as well as a cover, like kind of a call for action or something like that. And that's resources. And it includes a review of the Shriver book with some of the details on it. One thing I mentioned earlier about Hiroshima is how the political or the debate in our culture has been very one-sided. I mean, we complain about the Japanese not being willing to apologize, and I have to say I was appalled at what they came up with recently, just a few weeks ago. It was in front pages of the newspaper. It was really appalling that they weren't able to do better than to note with regret that bad things were done, to use the formulation that Ronald Reagan made famous. Mistakes were made. Doesn't quite qualify as an apology by Reagan or the Japanese. This is a really amazing and the shortest of the articles that I've seen that help us understand how badly we've done at even acknowledging what high-ranking military officials themselves said at the time or shortly thereafter. This information was cut out of the Smithsonian exhibit before it even was made public. I mean, these kinds of quotes didn't even make it off the cutting room floor in the internal construction of the exhibit. And if Eisenhower cannot be heard about what his debates in the discussions in the White House before the bomb was dropped, let alone, you know, after in his memoirs and number of speeches, if the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, if the chief of staff of the Army, if Douglas MacArthur cannot be heard on this debate, something is seriously wrong with the way the United States is looking at its past.
How quickly did this defensiveness and denial solidify within our society? society? Was it the Cold War that did that, or what was it exactly?
Yeah, I mean, one of the really hopeful things that I found in doing work on this was the apology that came out very, very soon afterwards from the churches. And I should say the churches were way ahead on the Japanese side as well. For some reason I'm not spotting my quote here. Yeah, 136. Maybe that's probably the Japanese one. Yeah. I'll quote that. That's useful to know. 1967, the United Church of Christ in Japan issued a confession, not far in spirit from that of Darmstadt 20 years earlier, stating on behalf of Japan's tiny minority of Christians that they had, quote, neglected to perform our mission as watchmen over the life of their nation during the war, and sought forgiveness from the churches and other brothers and sisters of the world, and in particular of Asian countries, and from the people of our own country. Very strongly reflects the box at the bottom of the interview with the Japanese Lutheran professor of what the Japanese churches just in the last year have done, 2 years have done as well. But the predecessor of the National Council of Churches issued a very strong I'm really grateful for them, statement condemning the bombing. And Norman Cousins had a very widely quoted editorial in the Saturday Review, and quite a number of other publications, you know, were appalled that we'd done it, or that we had dropped a second bomb so closely afterwards, you know, where there really wasn't time for them to do anything. Or I guess the worst single example of U.S. culpability was the day of the surrender by the Japanese. General Henry Arnold, one of the major planners of the U.S. bombing strategy, was desperately attempting to arrange, quote, as big a finale as possible, unquote, to end the war. It was his dream to hit Tokyo with a final 1,000-plane air raid, and on the night of August 14th, he succeeded in collecting such a force and sending it against the already devastated capital city. A total of 1,014 aircraft, 828 B-29 bombers, and 186 fighter escorts bombed Tokyo without a single loss. President Truman announced Japan's unconditional surrender before all of them had even returned to their bases. I guess I want to emphasize, I don't think it's right for me to take sides one way or the other, but I think as part of that, you know, having the courage to confront truth, to confront moral truth, I think it's important for us to have access to that information, to be able to share. Not necessarily in, you know, I don't know how far any of us are going to be able to go in some public discussion or whatever. I think there's a pastoral role as well as a prophetic role that needs to inform the way we do it. But I personally, I guess what I'm telling myself is, I don't want to not say something for lack of courage on my part, just for my own personal weaknesses. I want to do what is right, both for the memory of those who fought on our side, but also for a balancing out of some of the realities. I mean, just casualties alone, 300,000 U.S. troops died in the entire World War II, and that is less than died in Tokyo, Hiroshima, and Nagasaki alone, civilians, people that had no choice really in the war, or maybe many of them, you know, supported it in one way or another, but I think by that time most of them were finished, you know. How many of you are going to be around in a week from today? Anyone? Well, I thought that if that was the case, I thought that we might end by simply going through the liturgy that's listed here. I don't know if we'll have time to do the text as well. Does that sound reasonable?
Sure.
And I'll stick around for a few minutes afterwards if people have questions or want to take a look at any of the resources that we've cited. We'll start with the call to worship then. How beautiful upon the mountains
are the feet of one who brings good news, who proclaims peace.
Blessed are you, O Christ, our peace.
For through the cross you have broken down the dividing walls of hostility and created a single new humanity.
We ask you, O God of peace,
that you guide us not to learn war anymore, but the things that make for peace.
Blessed are those who come
to prepare the way of the Lord, to guide our feet and way of peace.
Micah 4, 1 to 5 is, of course, the breaking of the swords into plowshares and the spears into pruning hooks, and the integral connection between peace and justice they show.